in the image she had created because the person failed to live up to it. As soon as she began to realize that this person was not an image of herself, that it was not possible for this person to fulfill her expectations, but that this person could fulfill certain natural expectations and could grow, and being good-hearted would grow. In a little while, the situation became greatly improved, and certain tensions let down, and a certain guidance which this man needed took the place of nagging. And things worked out very much better, and this man is going to become a very stable citizen. He's going to grow. But what was blocking the family was that the wife thought he already knew and was only stubborn. He did not really know. And so we have to watch these things, and only in quietude and in analysis can we discover some of them. If we brush along clinging to our own interpretations without thoughtfulness, demanding from others what we expect of them rather than what they can provide, we're going to be hurt. We're going to hurt them, and they're going to hurt us. If we gradually develop discrimination, however, we will not expect the unreasonable. We will understand why other people misunderstand us. That it is not merely that they want to hurt us, but that they are not equipped to take on the attitudes that we wish them to take on. Let us also then ask ourselves another question. Do we really know the value of the attitudes we want them to take on? Are we so completely right ourselves that they would be emancipated by becoming like us? Would the fact that they became cut-out copies of our own deportment assure their salvation and our eternal happiness? Usually, no. In the first place, the individual who is trying to change others is usually in desperate need of change himself. The patterns which he regards as proper have produced very little for him except trouble. He values them not because they are right, but because they are his. And he assumes that all others can be wrong, but he cannot be. So this statement that we hear so often in reply to advice, "Well, if I was in your place, I would do it this way," is utterly meaningless. If the other person was in our place, he would do exactly as we have done, because the place created the situation. We have no reason to assume that anyone will be better by doing it our way, unless we can prove that our way has been astonishingly successful in matters of real value. The mere fact that by our way we have managed to accumulate a few extra dollars or risen a few steps on the social ladder, these things are of no importance to communicate to anyone else. If our way has made us happier, wiser, better people, then perhaps there is some advantage. But if our way has only locked us within a pattern of personal conceits and opinions, it is of no importance even to ourselves. So there is much to be said in favor of not attempting to judge other people's attainments by measuring them against our own. We have tried this policy for ages. And we have discovered gradually, as time went along, that people are quite individual, and that abilities which we feel others need, they may not need as much as we think they do. Perhaps it is better if we can help them also to that degree of quietude in which they can discover their own abilities. Here again, your acceptances are very important. Careers are problems of acceptances. Dr. Schweitzer made a series of acceptances. Abraham Lincoln made a series of acceptances. He knew before he started out the problems that he faced. And there are even records that he anticipated the probability of his own assassination. He accepted responsibilities and chose to carry them, and developed around his acceptances a very simple philosophy of life, which has made him one of America's greatest citizens. He had no complicated theories, but he did have a clear insight as to duty. He had this courage to do what he believed to be right, and he was wonderfully gifted in the simple honesties which enabled him to choose right things that were reasonably right. So we find that men of great stature in this world have usually come to their knees and asked the help of heaven and the presence of God and the guidance of truth in all of their undertakings. Great people are nearly always humble, accepting people, seeking always from within themselves some guidance, some clue, some strengthening of conviction to give them the courage to go on and do the things that are necessary. As soon as they become complicated, they become wrong. And that is another point in connection with this situation of acceptances. Errors can become very confusing, very complicated, until the judgment of the wisest will not be sufficient to divide the false and true. But realities, truths, are very simple, very basic. The individual senses and feels realities, if he permits himself to. He knows by the reaction within himself what is good and what is not good. He gains a certain inner strength when he follows the truth as he knows it. He weakens himself the moment he departs from this conviction. The moment he knows that he compromises his own principles, he has weakened himself. He has lost respect for himself. He has lost faith in himself. Then he turns to all these outside sources of possible support and becomes completely lost in a maze of confusion and conflicting opinions. In philosophy and religion, then, the concept of the retreat was long ago developed. That every year a person should retire for a few days from the turmoil of things to the quietude of self-analysis, the quietude of communion with realities, with unworldliness. The moment that is spent in the presence of that which is truly significant. Today we are hardly able to see the world for the houses. We are hardly able to sense the divine universe because we are hopelessly tied up in subdivisions and building projects. To us today, the world is nothing but freeways, tying great centers of industry and commerce together. We have a sense of the importance of the things we do, the importance of the attitudes that we take, and most important of all, the need for this tremendous ambition drive that will enable us to outwit our competitors. We have to get away from this occasionally, because it is a false world, a completely false one. No matter how we try to prop it up, it is not going to stay in one piece. No matter how we try to support and perpetuate these problems, they fall, they disappear, new patterns arise, And in 50 years, practically every notion that we hold today on industry, economics, and politics may be extinct. Certainly, it will be outmoded. The only things that will not change are the relationships between man and the essential facts of living. The things that will not change will be the communion with space itself, our relationship to the infinite life within us and around us, and our utter dependency upon universal life for our existence day by day. We will still be dependent upon realities, even while we watch the unrealities to which we have dedicated so much time and energy fall to pieces around us. So man must constantly strive to restore a certain orientation in strength. Orientation in the quietude of space itself, with its vast harmonious patterns of energies. Energies that are not fighting and struggling, but are moving majestically through eternity. The individual must sense his relationship with eternal life, not merely with a career of a few years and old age pension. Unless he is able to get a separate look at values, he is going to be drowned in false attitudes. If he gets this separate look at values, he can then begin to plan how to handle things which are not so valuable. Once he is free from this entanglement of hypnosis of things, once he no longer accepts his own achievements as superlative and ultimate, once he escapes from the belief that man can be everything and do all, and begins to recognize his true relationships with life, he can relax and he can begin to plan a useful, pleasant life here. When Eastern philosophy moved north and eastward in Asia, and set up the great northern schools of yoga, Vedanta, Tantra, Buddhism, a major change took place in the basic psychology of these groups. This change was to the effect that once man has conquered tension in himself, he can adjust to the world and have the advantages of everything that is good in the common way of life around him. It is not necessary that he renounce all worldliness and depart on his lonely journey to the infinite. The only point is that he must have a center. He must have some orientation that is strong enough to prevent him from abusing the immediate material things which surround him. If the person is quietly addicted to value, if he knows in himself something of the reason for his own existence, he may then also accept cheerfully and wisely the realization that he is born into this world, that he is here for a purpose, that he is here to learn more and to work with people in the achievement of a realization of the actual, factual identity of life. It is therefore quite possible for him to make a living, to choose a profession, to become famous or remain obscure according to his own interests. He may accumulate all that he needs. He may gain knowledge. He may become a student, a philosopher, or a scholar. He may do almost anything that he wishes to do, from being a simple farmer to being the chief of state. Any situation that arises is within his power and within his pattern and within his possibilities, as long as he evaluates these things correctly. If he realizes that in terms of value, it means absolutely no difference whatever whether he is the farmer or the chief of state. The important thing is to be himself, to live a constructive life, And when he does not care, it is probable that he will make an ideal chief of state, because then he will be incorruptible. He cannot be touched because the things that corrupt most people no longer interest him. He has his core in value. He knows what is valuable. And he will no longer deceive himself, and he will no longer compromise himself, and he can no longer depart from the light that is already within his own consciousness. It is in there. He cannot go against it. So inspired and strengthened by this light, he may live constructively on almost any level of society. He may achieve any reasonable end. And whatever he does do will be done honorably, will be done with a full spirit and a full heart. He will do these things in a way that will bring distinction to his profession or his trade. And he will probably be inspired with a great deal more creative artistry than the person who lacks this inner adjustment. Actually, the person who has achieved this acceptance is the only person who is free. He is free because there is nothing that can enslave him. He has already thoroughly rationalized and intuitively understood through ambition. He has recognized the uselessness of selfishness, that it can produce nothing of value. He has lost all ability to fall back upon hate or jealousy in the justification of himself. He knows his own faults. He knows his own weaknesses, and that efforts to justify them are useless. In substance, he has become honest. And being honest, he is also in a prime relationship with life in terms of growth. Knowing what he does not know, he is open to learning. He knows exactly what he needs to know and will never be obscured by sophistication and assume that he knows more than he does. The test of knowledge is to whether or not it will support him in his emergencies. If the knowledge doesn't work, it isn't knowledge. If the knowledge is only theory and cannot be applied to any particular situation, it is worthless. So the person is continually growing because he knows what he needs to achieve next. Having a completely honest estimation of himself, he can tell exactly the remedies for his own inadequacies. All of this is a very quiet procedure. There is no tendency to appear virtuous. There is no desire to put on airs, because they are recognized for their uselessness. Needless to say, such people are hard to injure. The most that we can possibly do is what the tyrant does: destroy their bodies. But these people cannot be destroyed as beings, because they will not compromise their principles. The death of the body is a minor situation that can be repaired. Nature has done it often. But the death of honor is a great disaster, very difficult to repair. The individual who compromises his integrities is far worse off than one who suffers martyrdom. So we have to recognize these basic values. In Christian religion, the acceptance principle is clearly indicated in many of these statements of Jesus, especially in the Sermon on the Mount. Here we are strongly advised never to return evil for evil. Never to believe in ourselves as too wise or too knowing. Always to remain much as little children in the presence of the majesty of life and reality. that it is not our purpose or our place to be arrogant, but rather our proper emotion to be forever grateful. Everything that makes up life can bring out of us either constructive reactions or destructive ones. The individual of acceptances is also the person of gratitudes. And we have much in this world to be grateful for, even in times which seem difficult. We have the right to be grateful for the mere fact, perhaps, that we live in a strenuous generation, for it is a generation of great learning. We may see many things fail, but we will never live to actually see truth fail. We'll see its forms change. We will see it persecuted and perhaps martyred. But it will rise phoenix-like forever from the ashes of its own dead. Realities can never die, and non-realities can never be preserved. We see around us many inducements to turn thoughtfully to our own natures. We observe that never before have there been so many good reasons why we should think straight. Never before has it been more necessary for us to be wise, to be quiet, to be kind. Never before have there been so many demands upon our energies, upon our resources, and upon our strength. These demands require that we shall conserve our resources, that we shall save our energies, that we shall do nothing to uselessly waste any resource that we possess. There is every reason we should be sober and protect ourselves against all such escape mechanisms as alcohol, narcotics, and sedations. If we observe in our own natures that we are not adequate to these conditions and to these pressures, then our first and primary duty is to achieve adequacy. This is far more important than a new swimming pool. This is infinitely more necessary to us than a late model car. And adequacy means more to us in the universe than some passing advancement in our profession or business, which will add to our responsibilities and miseries unless we are big enough to carry these burdens with a right spirit. So no time at all is better than the moment to measure and estimate this term of adequacy in ourselves. Are we tired? Are we nervous, irritable, excited, depressed? Why? It is so easy to say that outside conditions are too much for us. But it is not quite so easy to say that we are too little for our own survival. Well, if man had tried desperately all through time to make a noble example of himself, if we knew that people were desperately striving, then we might say it's a terrible thing to have people live so well and have so many troubles. It is hard to believe that people who are so sincere should be in so many difficulties. But we cannot honestly say this. We cannot say that the overwhelming majority of human beings is really doing the best it can. It is doing the best it feels like doing at the moment. It is doing the best it can without making any improvement upon itself. It is doing the best it can merely to continue as it is. Today we are not finding the average person reacting constructively to the challenge of his own needs. When he finds himself in a serious situation, he seeks to escape only. He does not seek to solve. So humanity gradually divides into two groups. The larger group, which is simply increasingly sorry for itself. and a smaller group that beginning to realize the facts is gathering resources to do something about it. And this was the point that Spengler brought out when he noted clearly that the second half of the 20th century would require that the world restores a philosophic foundation for life, that we must move existence from this temporal consideration of advantage to the eternal consideration of values, of realities. So the smaller group is trying to get better. The larger group is just taking aspirin, trying to forget that it hurts. The group that is continuing to take aspirin will have its reward. It will probably finally fall into a coma and rest there for a few millennia. But when it does wake up, it'll be in exactly the same spot it's in now. Because evasion and the lowering of our ability to react to a stimulation does not solve anything. It is the smaller group that coming clearly to realize that it is wrong, that its patterns are not adequate, that its systems are not correct, that the policies which have never succeeded must be changed. This smaller group, finding itself perhaps leaderless, finding its sphere of world influence very limited, and that the great decisions are being made by the irresponsible, is finally confronted with the same decision that every thoughtful person has been faced with since the dawn of big time. He has to start out for himself. He has to assume that the one thing he can do is work himself over and get himself straightened out. Because if he is successful in doing this, he will find a direction for his own efforts, and he will also be able to estimate the world condition without simply being angry. The world of the angry men is also totally worthless. If we have the values clearly set, we will be able to recognize integrities and be very grateful that the law does operate, even though it is not always to our satisfaction. The person seeking relief from tension has to make some decision. With 50% of our population neurotic today, and this is a conservative estimate, a lot higher figures are being presented almost hourly. With this situation, it is obvious that the population cannot depend upon counselors and analysts and psychologists to take care of this enormous group of needy, even if these specialized areas could take care of them. And with the exception of a few violent cases which have to have psychiatry, the success of treatment is still a very open matter. For the reason that no matter how hard you work with a situation, you cannot restore something that has actually spoiled itself. So the individual knows that psychotherapy is a long, expensive, and uncertain way of treatment, and at the end of it is likely to be only an adjustment to a situation which is itself wrong and will ultimately prove intolerable again. Some way, then, other methods of therapy have to be developed. Religious psychology has come forward in this, not so much, unfortunately, in terms of religion as in the form of bringing counselors into churches. But religion does have this one great advantage. It has created codes or beliefs which it has implanted in the young. And while some of these may not be entirely desirable, some of these codes, certainly they recommend self-control. That there are standards of right that must be obeyed, and that the child begins to obey them in early life. Religion is the only group today that gives this basic instruction. It is not available in schools, and it is not usually available in homes. And even if it was available in homes, its influence is not sufficiently strong. Whereas if a religious group is well represented in a community and well respected, it has a considerable aura of influence over young people. So if this religious group starts in with the young child, teaching that child to love God and to be true to his fellow men, to be honest in his dealings, to be kind, to seek truthfulness, to be modest, to keep his virtues, and in all things to be mindful that he has a destiny in the future, a destiny in the universe which he must return to, bills that he must pay, and that his future depends upon his integrity now. If these things can be brought home to the young, we have the foundations of self-discipline. These teachings are far more valuable than any later psychotherapy after the damage is done. So we feel that it is very necessary to maintain this religious sphere of influence, a religious sphere that is not sectarian, that does not make membership in a particular church the outstanding virtue, but makes obedience to the laws of God and nature the great virtues. If we can maintain these institutions and perhaps gather greater dignity for them by their own broadening and deepening and an increasing fellowship of faiths throughout the world, if religions can overcome their own differences and unite to teach a simple, honest, honorable code to the young, we will have a strong line of defense against the psychological problems that now disturb us. Most persons who are in trouble today, psychologically, morally, ethically, and we might say culturally, are persons of inadequate background. They may have come from wealthy backgrounds, they may have been well educated, but they were not taught and inspired to respect, honor, integrity, and value, nor were they given a deep faith in any principle or power superior to their own desires. In other words, their spiritual culture was neglected. They then come in middle life to an analyst, having built a false life, a life in which they have achieved a certain amount of haphazard success. And this success, well interlarded with misery, reverse, and disillusionment. These people, because they are now in a crisis, seek to be straightened out. But for 40, 50, or maybe 60 years, these persons have never imposed any control upon themselves. They have never accepted the sovereignty of anything superior to their own desires, attitudes, opinions, and feelings. These persons, whenever they wanted to be angry, they were angry by divine right. Whenever they wanted to be stubborn, they were stubborn. Their virtues were never deep enough to prevent them from making the basic mistakes that have disfigured their lives. No psychotherapy can help these people unless it can re-educate them. And to re-educate them means that they must gain the skill and the strength to impose some regimentation of value upon their own lives. This has been one of the secrets of Alcoholics Anonymous. It has required a certain acceptance of the fact of God, of the presence of a spiritual power that will help man if man will help himself. And it is the acceptance of this superior power that has been the strength of this movement. Everywhere, acceptance means the renunciation of self and self-purpose in the acceptance of that which is superior. And in our present problem, this acceptance applies the person coming under the discipline of a power stronger than himself. The moment egoism, which is self-centeredness, is brought under subjugation to something above egoism, the moment the right to do as we please is subordinate to the conviction that it is our duty to please to do that which is right, that we are accountable for our conduct. The moment we begin to think this way, we are in a position to begin to discipline our own attitudes. When temper arises, we can simply say, this is contrary to my code of right. This code is more important than I am. This code is more important because it is revealed by God. It is supported by natural law. And I know that if I break this code, I will suffer. With such inducements, the person will make a little better effort to keep his code. He will feel also that there is a certain support for him in the keeping of his code. He will learn, as all wise people have learned, that nature makes it easiest for those who do decide to keep the code. If man, therefore, tries to do exactly as he desires, he may gain no support from nature and find nature actually against him. But if, on the other hand, he obeys the principles which he regards to be right, and he is right, then the whole strength of universal right is on his side. Nature wants him to be normal. Nature has decided what normal is. Nature declares that virtue is normal, health is normal, wisdom is normal, friendship is normal. These are the normal things. And the individual who aligns himself with these normal things has the full support of nature. It will cooperate with him. It will advance him to the degree that he advances these principles through his own conduct. Words mean nothing. They must be supported by conduct. So, if we like to say, as the very devout person, that if we ask God's help, and we are sincere, this help will be available. We are simply saying in another way, that if we are actually dedicated to right, this right, everywhere in the universe, is available to us as strength. And when we ask, in the name of right, for its protection and help, we are asking no more than is automatically ours anyway. But perhaps through the asking, we gain a certain further sense of security. We are not asking intercession. We are trying to clarify the fact that if we obey the rules will protect us. But we have to subjugate our own will to the rules. The story of the fall of Lucifer is the story of self-will and its disaster. It is a legend to be found in some form throughout the whole world. The idea of man doing it his way in a divine world and coming to trouble. Acceptance brings us back again to the acknowledgement of the universal way and permits us to bend our knee in humility and yet in dignity to a plan that is so great that there is no dishonor in obeying it, only honor. That this plan is something which does not enslave us, but makes us free men. And it is this plan that does not weaken us by making us obey, but rather strengthens us through the acceptance of proper obediences. There is therefore every possible inducement in nature to unite all scientific knowledge available to us with this simple religious discipline, which if we receive it into ourselves at any age, transfers leadership from the ego, from this personal self, from the center of selfness in our own natures, transfers our leadership from this center to a universal center. So that instead of following our own opinions into chaos, we follow the will of the universe along the path of eternal growth and light. When we make peace with the infinite, we achieve serenity of spirit. And if we have peace with the infinite, at what can we be at war? There is no other power that is real. So in this type of thinking, we recognize strong acceptances. The acceptances of brave people who bend the knee to truth, who will allow no tyrant to rule their lives, that will fall under no tyranny, but will accept without question the leadership of truth itself. For if it is true that brave men are born leaders, it is also true that all brave men are born followers of truth. For it is truth that gives them bravery. It is the truth of principle that gives true courage. And actually, as the knights of old did their vigils in the cathedrals, dedicating their swords and their helms to the service of God, so modern man, in all of his adventurings in this complicated world, he may be a leader over other men, but he does not deserve to be a leader until he is a follower of principles. The individual who does not take orders from the universe has no right to give orders to other men. And to recognize this relationship, we have to establish the acceptances built upon thoughtfulness, upon quietude, upon integrities, upon values, and upon peace of soul. So in the quietude of vigil, before the altar of the great cathedral, or before the matchless altar of our own soul, the individual must make his dedications. And once he has made his dedications and has loyally resolved to keep them, his life is secure. And he will remain under the protection of his own dedications. They will never fail him. He may fail them. But these truths and principles, once made part of consciousness, will protect us not only in this world, but in the infinite future that lies beyond. We have to accept birth into this world. We have to accept life here. We have to accept death when the hour comes. And we live in the full realization that we will accept the future, that we will accept immortality, the divine plan, whatever it may be, and through acceptance will move with truth to its own ends. When we get a real sincere feeling about this, when we become truly dedicated quietly within ourselves, I do not think we will have near so many troubles. I do not think problems will seem nearly so great. And I don't think it will be so hard for us to be kind and just and thoughtful. All of these good things of our temperaments and dispositions arise from the simple acceptances which we make inside, and a clear, firm, quiet dedication to truth, in which we place our hope, our faith, and to which we dedicate our minds and our hearts and our hands. With these rather simple patterns, I think our neurotic problems will decrease. We will not need so much artificial help, because we will have the continuing help of nature, which will always support us while we are keeping the rules. Well, I think our time is up, and so...